Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. I'm Jason Ratliff here with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, and we have just gotten through the Major League Baseball trade deadline, and that is what we're going to talk about. That and only that. But there is plenty to talk about. There were 47 prospects who are either ranked at the time that they were traded or have been ranked since they were traded in the days leading up to the deadline. Of course, the big one that everybody was talking about leading up to the deadline, and we will now analyze now that it finally happened, the big Juan Soto trade. It did, in fact, happen. There was some question as to whether the Nats would pull off a deal, and they did. That is done. Let us analyze it. We'll open up with that. We're going to also, as we always do, wrap up by answering some questions from the mailbag. We're going to have a bit of an extended mailbag segment, as several people had questions regarding the trade deadline that they wanted answered. So we'll do that at the end of today's episode. Guys, let us dig in to the big one. We talked about it quite a bit leading up to the deadline. Came down not quite to the, I don't know if you'd say the wire, but it was deadline day. And Juan Soto. And then there was the surprise element the day of, was that Josh Bell was going to be included too. Padres land Soto, give up a hefty chunk of young talent. First of all, going into it, were you guys convinced that there would be a deal made?
Yeah, it sounded like it. I mean, Jonathan and I split up. We were kind of on call to MLB Network for the trade deadline. I had the morning shift because Jonathan was out in the West Coast still. And I can't remember if it was Joel Sherman or John Paul Morosi or somebody, but somebody at like 9 a.m. Central Time was like, it's definitely happening today. And it just seemed like it seemed inevitable. I don't think they should. We'll talk about this. Those trades never work out good for the team that trades the superstar, a young superstar. But I do get the whole concept of the team's about to be sold. And if I'm the new owner, I don't want to buy the team and then say we can't afford Juan Soto and then trade him. I want you to trade Juan Soto now, so when I buy the team, the fans could be mad at the learners rather than me. And so that's why I felt like it was kind of inevitable that he was going to get traded. How about you, Jonathan?
Yeah, and no, I think so. I hadn't really thought about the timing of the ownership change. So I had a half a minute. I was like, well, if the right deal doesn't come their way, you know, maybe they wait till the offseason. They had the benefit of some time. Obviously, teams that are competing now, adding Juan Soto's bat, that adds some value. So I felt maybe a touch less confident that it was going to happen, but I think it's mostly just because I hadn't really contemplated what you said, Jim, about, you know, the new ownership not wanting to be the bad guys in effect. So that makes a whole lot of sense, and it certainly created a lot of excitement.
And to their credit, I mean, I do think what you said, Jonathan, is true. I don't think the Nationals were just going to trade him for the sake of trading him. If they didn't get an offer that they liked, they could have waited. But I think, you know, again, we could talk about whether or not you're better off holding on to your superstar trading him. But I do think Mike Rizzo, the Nationals GM, did a nice job of leveraging a lot of young talent from the Padres. And, you know, I think he was helped by the fact that a year ago, AJ Preller and the Padres thought they were getting Max Scherzer from the Nationals. Ken Rosenthal, who has a higher standard of reporting than all these guys on Twitter who care about being first, actually had the deal being pretty much done and was wrong because he wound up with the Dodgers. And I just don't think AJ Preller was going to lose out again. And I think Rizzo probably knew that. And that's why they were able to get the package they got, because basically AJ Preller wasn't going to take no for an answer.
Yeah. It seemed like coming down to the final day there, the Dodgers and Padres were two of the final contenders. Cardinals seemed like they maybe dropped off a bit at the end when there was talk that they would not include
Dylan Carlson in a package. Did you guys feel like going into that final day it was either the Padres or the Dodgers, or did you think that it was a wider field than that?
I thought it was those. It was largely those two. You know, you always kind of leave that door open for that surprise team to come swooping in. But I just didn't think, you know, I think the Dodgers had the best system to deal from, you know, in terms of high-end players and depth. And the Padres had the willingness to, you know, to cash in all their, you know, all their chips. So, you know, those two did make the most sense, especially as you said, Jason, like when the Cardinals didn't want to part with, you know, a young big leaguer like Dylan Carlson, you know, that there was a limit to how much they could offer from a prospect standpoint. They would have had to give up some, well, you know, frankly, you know, not quite the caliber of CJ Abrams and Mackenzie Gore, but, you know, young players at the big league level. And, you know, there were very few other teams who could, you know, because it's not just trading for Juan Soto. It's trading for Juan Soto and even just being able to afford him for the, you know, for the next 2 years, even if they don't sign him to an extension now. Maybe a team could bring him in and then trade him again a year from now. You know, if the Padres aren't able to figure something out, maybe we see that happen. But I felt that those two teams made the most sense.
I think that's well said, Jonathan. I think the Cardinals were involved from what it sounded like, but they were not – I don't think the Cardinals had the financial resources or quite the depth of the Dodgers, although they do have a lot of young talent, especially if you factor in the major leaguers too. And they didn't have the "we'll do whatever it takes" attitude of the Padres. So it just seemed like they were more kind of the fallback maybe if those deals fell through and Mike Rizzo felt like we've got to move Soto today. Then maybe the Cardinals would have resurfaced, but it sounded like it was going to come down to LA versus San Diego in the end.
And you said, Jim, that they, you know, San Diego was willing to put all their chips in. Let's talk about the chips now. You mentioned a couple of the players in Mackenzie Gore and CJ Abrams, who of course are no longer technically prospects in terms of, you know, still having their rookie eligibility. They graduated from prospect lists earlier this year, but we are, and probably anyone listening to this podcast is well acquainted with them in terms of you know, their level of prospect stardom. They're both top 10 overall prospects in the game of baseball at one point. Abrams going into this year, Gore, of course, has had a bit of a roller coaster ride in terms of his prospect status. But you get those two guys, and then a couple more top 100 prospects in Robert Hassel III and James Wood, who ranked number 21 and number 88 in baseball and were the Padres' number one and three prospects. And then another player in Yoelin Susanna, who was only number 14 on the Padres' list, but another intriguing player, younger guy, huge, and has been very, very good and very limited action, but a lot of intrigue there. Bit of a flyer, I guess.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I mean, he's a flyer because he's young, but he was the best pitcher on the international market this year. And at 18, he's already throwing upper 90s with an upper 80s slider. So I think there's more unknown with him because he doesn't have track record, but he's pretty exciting dude. I'm conferring full dude status on Susanna along with all the other guys in the trade, except for Luke Voit.
Yeah, so Hassel, Wood, and Susanna move over to the Nats list, where they become Washington's number 1, 4, and 8 prospects.
And I'll say this. I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt again. We haven't revamped the list yet, our top 100 list, which will come later in the month. So the top 100 guys are kind of locked into where they are in the current list. I think you could make a case that James Wood is their first or second best prospect now, whatever you want to put him in with Robert Hassel. I know the Padres, there were guys in the Padres organization who thought James Wood was better than Robert Hassel. So, I mean, that might be their top two guys, because it's not like Cade Cavalli and Brady House are covering themselves with glory this season in the national system.
Cavalli has been better lately. Let's talk about each of these guys. I don't know how much time you want to spend on Abrams and Gore. They're, you know, we've seen them in the big leagues, talked about them obviously extensively over the years. But if you want to touch on them, and let's focus on the other three pieces too that the Nats get here.
Jim doesn't like to talk about Mackenzie Gore.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I just wrote about all these guys in my newsletter, so I've got prepared remarks. But Jonathan, if you want to go first, not just about Mackenzie Gore, like, why don't you go first and then I'll chime in?
That's fine. I mean, I'll just say quickly, you know, Gore and Abrams are just, you know, just establishing themselves. A ways to go, and you know, Gore was pitching very well when he first came up, you know, after the roller coaster, as you pointed out, Jason, but has not been pitching well of late. You know, Abrams has unbelievable upside, rushed to the big leagues. You know, I think he got up a little faster than people thought he might, kind of on the same timeline as Bobby Witt Jr., but I think they're both going to continue to figure it out. Hassel, you know, is a guy who's always been able to hit. The power hasn't shown up a ton. It's a little bit, you know, good extra base ability, but not a ton of over the fence power. And I think that's going to determine just how good he is. Futures gamer, good base runner, plays good defense, you know, but it's kind of that hit over profile, hit over power profile sort of makes you wonder a little bit. Well, Wood has a higher, you know, a higher ceiling than Hassel for sure.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's like, you can look at this trade with prospect colored glasses and be a Nationals fan and dream that all these guys are going to be stars. Cause you know, Mackenzie Gore gave up 8 runs in his first 9 big league starts and showed why at one point he's considered the best pitching prospect in the game. Abrams and Hassel are outstanding hitters with a lot of tools. You know, Abrams has top of the scale speed for one. They also have some defensive versatility. Wood had one of the highest ceilings in last year's draft. Cisano was the best pitcher on the 2021-22 international market. But then the flip side of it is, if you go back and look, I'm sure we're going to talk about prospect hauls for other mega trades later in the podcast. These guys are prospects. They're not sure things. And right now, not only was Gore not pitching well, Gore's got a strained elbow right now. He's hurt. Abrams, you know, I know he's young and I know he got rushed, but he's shown very little power or patience at the plate in the majors. You know, Jonathan pointed out Hassel might, you know, if he doesn't have more power, might be a floor guy rather than a ceiling guy. He has yet to play above high A. Wood is yet to play above single A. Cisano has yet to play above rookie ball. And so they're interesting. But I think, you know, if you look at the history of prospects, if two of these guys wind up being as good as the Nationals hope, they probably did pretty well. Like that would be a good percentage. And so you could dream big, and you have to if you just traded Juan Soto. But these trades don't usually pan out very well for the teams trading superstars.
Did you guys think that – I mean, Jim, you said that you thought Rizzo did a good job, so I guess the answer to this is yes. Did you think that they got enough?
Yeah, I thought they got as much as you were going to get. Yeah, I think he did a good job of maximizing the return. You know, and like I said, I mean, I don't know, I'm not involved in ownership level discussions in Washington, but this very well may have been, you know, Mike Rizzo was told, look, team's getting sold. The new owners, you know, don't want to have to take the heat for this. So we got to trade him now, make the best deal. And I will say like Jonathan, and I'll ask you too, Jason, I feel like they got more, like if you had asked me, okay, what do you think they're going to get? I think they got a little bit more than I thought they might have. Because again, people knew they wanted to trade Juan Soto.
I don't know about that. It's such an unusual situation. He's so young. You still have, you could keep him for 2 years, trade him at the trade deadline 2 years from now if you wanted to, if you can't sign him to to some sort of large extension. I don't know that I think it was about right. I thought he did very well given that, you know, he may have been forced to trade him. He didn't just trade him because he had to. He got, you know, a really, really big return for him. But I think because of who Juan Soto is, it was not like it didn't outstrip my expectations by that much.
Well, I think both of those can be true, Jonathan. I think those are both good points. Like, I think they got a pretty nice prospect haul. I don't know that, like, I'll be shocked if they win this trade when we look back at this trade in 15 years, like in terms of what they, I mean, maybe you could say they won the trade if Juan Soto was guaranteed to leave in 2.5 years and a couple of these guys really pan out. But I kind of agree with both those points, Jonathan.
Like, yeah, that's fair.
I wouldn't have, if I had my choice, and again, I don't know what ownership's telling him, I'd rather have Juan Soto than trade him for, than trade him for anything. Pretty much, like right now, like you said, I've got 2 years to figure out new ownership. Maybe I can sign him. And you know, it's funny. You know, I know he turned down a 15-year, $440 million deal. But if I'm Juan Soto, I've already made, you know, tens of millions in my career already. I have some security. I'm going to clean up an arbitration for a couple more years. And you're offering me a 15-year deal with less than an annual average value than Anthony Rendon just got, who's 6 years older than me when he hit free agency, and I'm a better player, and I don't know what new ownership's going to do. Plus, I'll ding the Nationals a little bit here. They've taken a team that won the 2019 World Series and turned it into garbage now. It's a bad team. Like, all their best players have pretty much left. The one guy they held on to, Steven Strasburg, has been hurt ever since he signed a couple $100 million contract. So if I'm Juan Soto, why do I want to take a below market? I have financial security already. I'm going to make at least $40 or $50 million in arbitration over the next couple of years. Why am I going to take a $440 million below market deal when I have no idea what the future of the team's going to look like? I'd rather retain my control to be able to play where I want, maybe play for a winner. So, it's a weird situation. And you know, I'm not the first person who said that, but I mean, this has been brought up a lot. I mean, the two biggest parallels when you're looking at super young superstar getting traded in baseball are Babe Ruth and Miguel Cabrera, who were both a year older. They were 24 when they were traded. And when the Red Sox traded Babe Ruth, they didn't have another winning season for 16 years. And when the Marlins traded Cabrera and Dontrell Willis to Tigers for six players, the only time they made the playoffs was in the pandemic season when everybody made the playoffs. Marlins haven't made the playoffs in a real season since then. So, and if you look at other sports, you know, teams making trades with superstars who are young usually doesn't work out very well. So it's not the fact that the Nationals got to this point does not reflect well on the Nationals.
How about the inclusion of Bell in the trade? I was surprised by that. And, you know, if you told me that the Padres gave up the players that they did just for Soto, I would have no problem believing that. It almost feels like Bell didn't have a lot of value in this trade.
I think there was interest, and he's a nice fit for the Padres, but he's a pending free agent. And how many teams acquired a first baseman yesterday? I think the only, or at the trade deadline, I think the only team that really acquired a first baseman was the Red Sox, which was really an offshoot of this trade because the Padres tried to jettison Eric Hosmer in this deal. He invoked his no trade clause, which I would have too if I were Eric Hosmer. Why do I want to go to a bad team that has no shot at making the playoffs and is going to be terrible, and I'm under contract for another 3 years? The Red Sox acquired Eric Hosmer and two prospects for Jay Groom. I mean, they basically, and the Padres are paying all of his salary but the minimum. So the only other, I think, like everyday first base type who changed hands at, you know, around the deadline was Hosmer. You know, Darren Ruff got traded, and he's, I think, going to be a platoon guy for the Mets. So I think that was just a case where maybe there wasn't a big Josh Bell market. I mean, I will say this. I mean, A.G. Preller never sleeps. So if there was a Josh Bell market where he could have gotten more separate value from not including Josh Bell in this trade, then, I mean, I'm sorry. I said this backwards. I got my teams confused. The National, Mike Rizzo works hard too. So I assume that Mike Rizzo explored the market for Josh Bell. And if he felt like he could have gotten a superior return, he would have done that. And, you know, maybe he was the lever to get the fifth player in the deal. Maybe they agreed on four players and were haggling over the fifth, and he was the fulcrum for getting the fifth player in the deal.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk about some of those trades. We're going to look at which systems improved the most with their trade deadline deals, and we'll talk a little bit about where this Juan Soto haul ranks among the biggest prospect hauls ever. That's coming up next on the MLB Pipeline Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Jason Ratliff here with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo. We are a day removed from the trade deadline as we record this. We just broke down the big Juan Soto trade, and now we're going to move on to, I guess, the next biggest trade at this trade deadline. And I don't know, would you have thought going into this deadline that this would have been the second biggest haul that Castillo would have yielded?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he was the best pitcher on the market, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he was. I mean, he was the top pitcher on the market with an extra year of control. So, you know, this isn't a 2-month rental here. So I think it, you know, it makes sense. All-star pitcher, you know, and deservedly so. So to answer your question directly, yes. In a word, yes.
And the Mariners paid a pretty hefty price for Luis Castillo. Just days before the deadline, they give up Noelvi Martinez and Edwin Arroyo, who were the team's number 1 and 3 prospects and both top 100 prospects, along with Levi Stout, who was Mariners' number 5 prospect and another pitching prospect, not on the top 30 list, but Andrew Moore. Obviously, Marte, the big one there, the number 17 overall prospect in baseball. Jonathan, these are both teams that you manage in terms of their prospect lists. What'd you think about this one?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting that, you know, while it didn't surprise me that this was that Castillo was the player who got the sort of second largest amount of prospects. I don't know that I would necessarily thought it would be 2 top 100 guys. You know, I thought maybe it would be 1 top 100 guy in, you know, depth kind of thing. Because the Reds are clearly, you know, they're really trying to restock. They're looking for quality and quantity. So, you know, I give them credit in this trade. I thought this was, you know, a good trade for them, you know, and maybe a very good trade for the Mariners because they got the starter that they needed for a playoff push, a team that's, you know, very talented. You know, Marte, we had ranked much higher. We knocked him down a little bit during one of our corrections because he was struggling. He'd been really figuring things out and very young for his level. And then Edwin Arroyo, you know, is really interesting. I'm very curious to see what happens with him because this was a guy coming out of the draft, was a guy who was like, he can really play shortstop, makes a lot of contact, but, you know, severe lack of strength, worry about the impact. And he's really hit well with some impact. You know, he's worked on adding strength already. I think there's going to be more to come. And he continues to show that he's going to play shortstop for a long time. Well, Marte probably moves to third or maybe you move him to the outfield, but he's such a talented offensive player. You know, so that those two players alone make this like a really exciting trade for the Reds. And then, you know, Levi Stout's an interesting arm, you know, even if he ends up being a reliever. And even Andrew Moore is sort of interesting as the fourth guy who was not ranked in the Mariners list, and I didn't add him to the Reds list, but he's someone worth watching as someone who, you know, as a draftee from last year, put up good numbers in the draft league. He does some things, you know, that are sort of interesting on the mound. So I thought that the Reds got as much a return as you could expect for Luis Castillo here.
Yeah, I thought they did really well in that one. I think that was a case maybe, Jonathan, where the Mariners have the biggest postseason drought, I think not just in MLB, but in the four major North American sports leagues. And so they were a little bit more highly motivated than it might have been. And as you noted, it's not just a rental. You know, you keep Castillo going forward. They still have a lot of young talent. So I like that. I really like that trade for both teams. It was, I mean, shocked that Jerry DePoto made an aggressive move, right? I mean, he never does that. But I thought that was like a real shot in the arm, and it's going to make him it can make him tough in the playoffs. And if I'm the Reds, like that package, when I saw the package, my initial reaction was like, wow, the Reds got even a little bit more than I might have suspected there.
All right, let's move on down the list. By the way, we should mention here that talked about the 47 prospects who were traded. Sam Dykstra has been following along with all these trades over the course of the past week or so, and was at the ready to spit out a full ranking of all 47 of the prospects who were traded in these deals leading up to the deadline. So you can find that on MLB.com/pipeline. Sam, as always, doing an excellent job there. Should we move on to what's the next one you guys want to talk about? The Yankees acquiring Frankie Montas and Lou Trevino?
Yeah,
because Montas after, right, Jim, I mean, after Castillo, Montas was the next best. I mean, when the Yankees missed out on getting Castillo, they clearly turned their sights to getting Montas.
Yeah, and they got Lou Trevino in the trade, who's been up and down a little bit, but has had some success in the past. And you know, I don't think, I mean, again, it's not exactly apples to apples because of contract situations and everything, but it was an okay trade. Like, it didn't blow me away. The Athletics haul didn't blow me away. I thought that was a good trade for the Yankees. I really like Ken Waldachuk. He's a top 100 guy. Doesn't seem like anybody hits his fastball, which has great carry in the strike zone. He's got secondary pitches as well. Probably, you know, big league ready. So I like that aspect of it. I'm not sure, you know, the other guys were all interesting. I do our Yankees prospect list. Like Louis Medina, you know, if we joke sometimes when we do our one for each team stories, I always joke when we don't have a topic like, hey, let's do the prospect fatigue one fit guys we're tired of writing about. And Luis Medina, Louis has some of the best stuff in the minors. Like the fastball can get triple digits, wipe out breaking ball, wipe out changeup. And he's never really thrown consistent strikes. And he's, this has been his MO for years now. And I think he might be a reliever in the long run, even though he has some of the best pure stuff in the minors. You know, JP Sears is a lefty who, you know, the stuff doesn't blow you away in terms of the radar gun, but he can pitch. He's kind of the crafty lefty. He's interesting. Cooper Bowman was a guy they drafted last year out of Louisville who's got some tools to him. But I guess why I didn't, this trade didn't blow me away, say like the Castillo trade is I just think in the long run, Medina's probably a reliever at best. Waiting too long for him to throw enough strikes to where you really believe he's a starter. And Sears is more of that pitches over his stuff guy, end of the rotation, multi-inning reliever guy. Like Waldachuk might be the only guy who's like a significant big leaguer to me in this deal.
Yeah, I think this was more a quantity over quality. And not, you know, the as you said, they're all interesting prospects, but there was no Elvi Marte in this deal. But I also think, you know, that Castillo, maybe I'm wrong here, but I feel like Castillo's rated a good notch ahead of Montas. So, you know, maybe it was more appropriate for what they, you know, what they were getting in terms of the tiers of starting pitchers. And there was not a lot of starting pitching on the market to be had. So, you know, maybe the A's should have held out a little bit more, but we don't know what they were getting offered. And, you know, they added a bunch of talent to a fairly barren system after the lockout, and but all those guys got added to their top 30, so you know, they still have work to do. So the positive for the A's is that they did get four top 30 players, you know, many of whom are at the upper level, so should help out whatever role they end up being in, whether, you know, starter or reliever, what they end up being in, utility guy for Bowman. Bowman's a little bit further away, but the, you know, the arms they got are all guys that should help within the next year.
All right. So that covers another top 100 prospect in Waldachuk, who was traded. Another one. And these first two deals that we've discussed have been sort of a bunch of prospects for big leaguers. And this one was a single top 100 prospect for a couple of big leaguers in Jordan Groshans, who goes from Toronto to Miami for Zach Pop and Anthony Bass. Groshans, number 82 on the top 100 prospects list, was number 4 on the Blue Jays list. Was this a surprise, or what were your general impressions of this deal?
Well, as our Marlins guy, I mean, you know, what Toronto is doing is getting some bullpen depth there. You know, Anthony Bass is having a nice year. You know, he's, I think, a 1.41 ERA, strikeout an inning. You know, Zach Pop's got a nice arm as well. So the Blue Jays were adding bullpen help. You know, Groshans, I don't think, we haven't done the re-rank yet, I don't think he's going to make the midseason top 100 because he just hasn't hit for power the last 2 years. I still like him. I still like the idea of buying low on him. I mean, if you had suggested this trade would have been made a year ago, we all would have laughed and said, come on, like, there's no way that trade's going to get made. But, you know, Groshans, even though he hasn't hit for power the last 2 years, still only 22 years old, he's already reached AAA. He hasn't played a lot because of injuries in the lockout. He's only played 218 games, so it's not like he's got 600 games under his belt and you're worried that the power is never going to come. I like the idea of buying low. Like, to me, if I'm a team that doesn't have a chance to win, relievers are so volatile in terms of, like, you never seem like you have enough relief help if you're trying to win. But how many relievers are really good year after year after year? It's like they're good 1 year, then not as much the next, then they bounce back some. They're all over the place. I would always trade, you know, non-elite relievers. I would sell high on them every trade deadline. And I think we saw a number of the non-contenders do that. So, again, I don't know exactly what Jordan Groshans is, but I'll buy low on him if I'm the Marlins and see what I can do with him.
Yeah, I think even if there is, you know, a standpoint of sort of a little bit of a down arrow next to his name, you know, this year, because he's really not been particularly impactful offensively for a reliever, as you said, like, I think it's certainly worth the gamble. Like, I think he's going to play in the big leagues just because of that field of hit. It's just a question of, will he, you know, have enough thump to play every day, probably a third base when all is said and done, or is he more of a utility guy? But even if you get a big leaguer for a reliever, I think that's a good get.
You guys are saying that the Blue Jays got pop for a guy without much pop. That's what you're saying.
That is what we're saying.
One home run this year, 644 OPS for Groshans. Coming off his first three seasons where he posted OPS of 799, 909, and 817. So significant drop off in this his fourth professional season. All right. Let's see. Who's up next? Our next top 100 prospect who was dealt was Logan Ohapi, who was dealt to the Angels from the Phillies for Brandon Marsh.
Two Jonathan systems, right?
Yeah.
I've got a hot take when you're done with this one, though, but I will defer to you first.
I think I know what it is, but Jonathan.
Well, you know, because I say this all the time. Yeah. But
yes. You know, no, I think we need to hear the hot take first.
Okay. Well, you know, it's funny because, yes, the Phillies need center field help, and Marsh can play center, but as you've known, I think both of you guys have known for years, I respect Brandon Marsh. You know, he was part of my draft territory. He was in my neck of the draft in Georgia back in 2016, was a guy who kind of emerged that spring. So I liked him there, but I just think this guy's been overhyped as a prospect. Do you know what his career slugging percentage is in the major leagues? I know he's not even that young. He's 24 now. His career slugging percentage in the major leagues.
330.
354. But what's his career slugging percentage in the minor leagues?
377.
No, 440. Yeah, way to go. I know you went low on me there. But outside of hitting, slugging 548 in the Pioneer League, he never hit for power in the minors. He was good in the Fall League where everybody hits. And I just think he is what he is, which I think he's going to be better than a 239 hitter, which is what he's been in the big league so far. But I think he's a guy who's going to hit like 270 with about 10 homers a year. He doesn't walk very much. He's not an on-base guy. I think the Angels absolutely fleeced the Phillies on this deal. Logan Ohapi, you know, wasn't a second-round pick, wasn't a prominent guy out of the draft, you know, he did play well in the fall league last year, and I think we all enjoyed talking to him. It was a good interview too. But Logan O'Hoppe is like an everyday catcher who's, I think, going to provide solid defense and hit. So I when I saw this trade, and you guys know, I think I said this on Slack, I think the Angels just totally schooled the Phillies there. And it was funny because on MLB Network, you know, and those guys are pinning. They're talking about how, you know, Marsh is great. He fills the center field void. Great trade for Dave Dombrowski. I think this is one we're going to look back in 3 or 4 years and say, why did they do that? And I know they have JT Realmuto, but JT Realmuto is 31. Catchers don't age particularly well. It's not like JT Realmuto is tearing it up. And I would have eased O'Hoppe in there over the next couple of years and had him be my catcher. I think they're going to regret this trade. So I thought that was – it wasn't one of the blockbusters, but kudos to the Angels and Perry Minasian. I thought that was one of the best trades of the deadline.
I don't think it's that hot of a take. And it, you know, I love Brandon Marsh. I've long been higher on him than you have, which is fine. And he's also, by the way, a fantastic like guy to talk to. So on the same par. So I like him, but I do think in a lot of ways you're right. I love Logan O'Hoppe. I think that he is going to be a very good big league regular behind the plate. And not just because, well, someone's got to be, you know, there are a lot of, it's hard to find a legitimate number one catcher. You know, there just aren't that many of them. And I think that he's going to be productive offensively. He's a very solid defender. Pitchers love throwing to him. So I think he's going to be better than what his numbers say. And his numbers are going to be pretty good once he gets there and probably sometime next year. Yeah, I agree. I think this was a good trade for the Angels, even if I like Brandon Marsh more than you do.
You know, a trade that ties into this one a little bit, another Phillies Angels deal with the Phillies getting Noah Syndergaard from the Angels for Mickey Moniak and Yadiel Sanchez ties in because the same two teams. You got Mickey Moniak going from the Phillies to the Angels, another outfielder there, and subject of one of your $25,000 wagers.
But both guys in that wager got traded at the deadline or around the deadline.
Yep.
Yeah. So new life for both of them. We'll see how that impacts the deal, which is career war. Who will have the higher career war between Mickey Moniak and Zach McKinstry? And the current
I'm winning right now. It's -0.7 to -0.9.
Well, that's something to be proud of.
A barn burner.
Well, my guy was a 33rd rounder in the draft, when your guy went 1-1. So I am proud. Well, I'm proud of Zach McKinstry.
We weren't handicapping this based on where they were drafted.
No, but at the time I brought it up, it was in the context of, I'm very bullish on Zach McKinstry, and I said at the time I thought he was going to be a better player. For some reason we're talking about Mickey Moniak in the same podcast, and I said I would take Zach McKinstry over Mickey Moniak while they were both in the minors. So I will pound that table still. I'm the guy. I'm gonna have to go out to Wrigley Field and cheer for Zach McKinstry now.
I am hoping that Mickey Moniak returning home to Southern California is going to breathe new life, and he's going to get a new opportunity.
He can't hit worse than 129 in Anaheim, can he?
I mean, I guess we can find out. He hit 091 in Philadelphia last year, so maybe.
He got a 40% strikeout rate in the big leagues. That is not going to go down as a very good number one overall pick. And what's crazy, we don't have to belabor Mickey Moniak. But the time, like, and it's funny because now there's revisionist history. There were guys putting 70s on his bat, and he's never been that player in the minors. It's crazy.
Sitting 310 this year in AAA, or wherever he's been. He hasn't played a lot.
One of two number one overall picks traded yesterday. Can you weed through all the trades from yesterday and think of who the other one was?
Boy.
It must have been a big leaguer, right?
It was. Another not so great number one overall pick. Kind of similar, I would say. But this guy's turned into a valuable big leaguer, not in the way you would have expected him to.
In yesterday's trades, or was it a pre-Tuesday?
Well, was it? I don't know when this one happened. Let's
see. I'm confused. I don't know.
It was the day before, but it was Matt Bush.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, Matt Bush, right. It's funny. I just scrolled up and looking through the prospects moves for the deadline, but I would not have gotten there fast enough.
All right. Does that cover all of our top 100 prospects who were traded?
I believe so.
I think it does. All right. Well, let's do this. Let's talk about which systems you think improved the most in terms of their addition of prospects over the trade deadline period. Obviously, we've talked about the teams that pulled in a big haul of players, and we talked about the Nats, talked about the Reds, talked about the A's. Is there anyone else that you think did particularly well in terms of the young talent that they added?
I mean, to me, go ahead, Jim, because I'm still gathering.
Okay,
thoughts.
I was going to say two that aren't nearly at the same level. I know it was painful for the Orioles to trade Trey Mancini. I like the fact they got Seth Johnson. I know he needs Tommy John surgery, but he was a supplemental first-round pick with a good arm who's performed well in the minors. Chase McDermott has been striking out a ton of guys in his first full pro season. They got him from the Astros in that deal. They got Cade Povich in the Jorge Lopez trade. I thought they did a nice job of adding some pitching depth. The Orioles already had a good system, so that's not vaulting them up to the top of the, you know, putting them over the top or anything. I guess we had them ranked number one beginning of the season when they still counted Adley Rutschman. And then I kind of liked when I was talking before about trading relievers to get prospects. I liked what the Cubs did, like kind of, again, not these weren't headline making moves. But they trade David Robertson, who's like 8,000 years old and not going to be part of the next Cubs contender, to the Phillies. And they got Ben Brown, who has a chance to be a mid-rotation starter. He's pitching very well this year. He's completely recovered from Tommy John surgery. You can give a shout-out. Jonathan, I stole this line from you because you wrote up Ben Brown for the Phillies. But they got Ben Brown in the 33rd round out of high school and Logan Ohapi in the 23rd round out of high school, both Long Island kids. Back-to-back drafts, same area scout, Alex Agostino. And both those guys look like they're going to be good picks. And not only did the Cubs get Ben Brown, who could be a potential starter for them, a couple days earlier, they traded Scott Efros, who has a ton of control remaining for the Yankees, but they got Hayden Wesneski, who's really, really good. I would have liked the A's deal better if Hayden Wesneski had somehow been the second player in that deal. But Hayden Wesneski is nearly a big league ready starter. And then, of course, going back to last week, since we're talking about Zach McKinstry, they turned Chris Martin into Zach McKinstry. So I like the Cubs making – I know people are wondering, why not Wilson Contreras? Why not Ian Happ? Why didn't they do more? But I think they did make some nice moves with their relievers.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. It's funny because it barely was a blip yesterday because I think not only are the Royals – for me, not only are the Royals not my team, but I think every trade they made – and I'm checking – no, that's not true. They actually when they got Drew Waters, it was the Braves. But I thought all the trades they made were not with teams I did. So like it barely registered. And after yesterday, it's all kind of a blur. But I don't know. What did you think, Jim? It's like, well, nothing earth shattering, but they added seven guys to their top 30 list. So again, that was a more volume over, any names that jump off the page.
They got three good arms from the Yankees. I mean, those were my guys in the Benintendi trade.
Yeah, I mean, that for in the Benintendi trade, and, they got Drew Waters, who, has some upside, but obviously there's some issues in Andrew Hoffman for a draft pick. And then for Whit Merrifield, they got a couple of interesting players from the Blue Jays. So I thought that was solid for them, given what they had to, what they were offering up.
Yeah, I think the Reds and the Royals were the two teams that added seven players to their top 30 prospects list. Jonathan, I know you are currently working on a story that kind of puts into context where this vast haul of prospects that the Nats got for Juan Soto ranks among the biggest prospect hauls that we've ever seen in trades like this. Can you give us a little sneak peek at your story, which will probably be up on MLB.com/pipeline by close to the time that people are listening to this.
Wow, some pressure there, Jonathan. You got to get that story done.
Well, I will. I was going to say the one correction I will make is that I am no longer working on it. So other people are working on getting it up on the site.
Oh, there we go.
So I look forward to seeing it. Yeah, it was sort of fun. And like, I think my main fear whenever you sort of dive into something like this is that you're going to miss a trade somewhere. And I went back, you know, and it was not just deadline deals. I looked at, you know, winter meeting trades and off season trades. So just sort of looking at overall prospect holes and not, I think the trick is not to look at the ones from a while ago and say, well, how did the prospects pan out? Because then how can you possibly put a trade from yesterday into context? So it was more about the buzz created when at the time of the trade, and, you know, trying to not have that sort of hindsight bias that comes with a, you know, trade. So, you know, the Juan Soto trade went at the top. I don't think that would surprise anybody given the return. But like the number two trade I went with was when the Rangers sent Mark Teixeira to the Braves in 2007 and got Elvis Andrus, Neftali Feliz, Matt Harrison, and Jarrett Sotolamacchia. Now that trade looks really good in hindsight, even more, even if Matt Harrison wasn't quite as good as people thought he might be, but like Feliz climbed into the top 100. You know, Sotolamacchia went from being a top 50 guy into being, you know, a good starting catcher. Yeah. So, but again, just putting a pause in that, when the trade was made, it seemed like the Rangers were getting a pretty good return, for that. And then the third was the Chris Sale trade, which was in December 2016. And if, you know, people I'm sure remember, wasn't that long ago when the White Sox in their rebuilding mode got Yoan Moncada, Michael Kopech, Luis Alexander Basabe, and Victor Diaz. Kopech was top 100, but the thing that really makes it stand out is that Yoan Moncada was our number one prospect. And it's the only time in ever, in 25 years it had been or so, that a top prospect, obviously long before we were doing our prospect rankings, but before, you know, a number one overall prospect had been involved in a trade. So that's the top three for you.
Yeah, that White Sox deal, December of 2016, just 7 months before another one of their trades that is on this list, dealt Jose Quintana to get Eloy Jimenez and Dylan Cease. Keep an eye out for that story. That'll be coming up soon. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to answer some of your questions, your deadline-related questions in the mailbag. That's coming up next on the MLB Pipeline Podcast.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Welcome back to this trade deadline edition of the MLB Pipeline podcast. Jim Callis, Jonathan Mayo, I'm Jason Ratliff. And we are going to wrap this thing up, as we always do, by taking a question or two, or in this instance, three, from the mailbag. A little extended, expanded version of the mailbag this week for you. And, well, if we're going to have an expanded mailbag, there's almost no way that Stevie D is not going to be in it. We'll lead off with him. Stevie D Ales 97 on Twitter asks, with the Juan Soto and Josh Bell trade happening, how does the Nationals farm system rank with the new crop of prospects entering their system? So I guess some context. Do you guys know where they ranked in our preseason rankings?
I'm going to say pretty low.
I do. 23rd.
Okay. And we are, of course, in the process of doing our midseason re-rank, and pretty early in that process, a lot to do in a short period of time here. So I don't know that you guys really would have had much time to really consider farm system rankings at this point, but
we have not. I will speak for both of us. Yeah, hope I'm not out of turn.
You may.
But I've spent 0.0% of my time worrying about farm system rankings to this point.
All right. So this will be a well-informed answer.
But no. But we actually did look at this. I looked at the infamous prospect points as a shorthand. I mean, there's two things to remember here. One, C.J. Abrams and Mackenzie Gore don't count as prospects. Yeah. So that's huge. If those guys count as prospects, it would be different. Two, I'm actually surprised we had him ranked as high as 23rd, because I don't think there's a lot of depth in that system, and there's still not a ton of depth. They have added three pretty interesting prospects who all rank in their top eight now to their system. To me, Jonathan, I think it's more top heavy than deep. They added Christian Vaquero as well. And I guess, are we counting? They got Elijah Green. I mean, that's going to help. But to me, it's a middle of the pack system. I don't think this is a top 10 system still. I think it is significantly improved through the trade, through adding the number five pick in the draft. It's not like they've had a lot of guys in the system have breakout years and up their stock. So I'm just going to give a general middle of the pack rather than top 10 farm system.
I think that's fair. You kind of expanded on the parameters, so Stevie was kind of just asking about the trade return. So I don't know adding
that's
Elijah
true.
Green, but I think, but I do think that, if you told me they end up around 15 or so, I think that's probably fair given what they got. And as you pointed out, if Abrams and Gore were still prospects, it would be a different, different conversation.
Okay. Next question comes from Ant-Man underscore 92, who is also a repeat question asker. Jim, I believe you mentioned before we started recording.
Yeah, I was extolling the virtues of Sean Ant-Man, who I think I might be out turn. I think he might be Canadian like Stevie D. But he had a great question in last week's Pipeline Inbox about the best sibling prospect duos in MLB Pipeline history, which I also expanded into the best sibling prospects in draft history. But he's bringing it again with a strong question for the second week in a row. So hit us with that one.
All right. So Ant-Man 92 asks, who is the most underrated prospect that was traded this deadline?
I'm going to pull a Jim Callis and give you two names.
Oh, no.
But very quickly, one is, from a team of mine, Spencer Steer might be underrated a bit, even though he's a top 10 prospect and might get top 100 consideration when we re-rank. I think he can really hit, the power continues to show up and he doesn't strike out. So that's the sort of one that coming to mind. And then I think after that, like a guy that wasn't mine, but it intrigues me more and more, is Yarlin Susana now with the Nationals, just because of the size and the arm strength. That as guys so young, they're touching triple digits, and he's 18 years old. He just signed in January. We'll see what happens. Long way to go. A lot could go wrong. A lot could go right. But I think we may look back at that, and that may be one of those like, oh, the Nationals got him then, because people will have forgotten, except that it was the Juan Soto trade. So maybe not.
I'm going to go much deeper on Sam's top 47 list. I'm actually intrigued by prospects 43 through 45, but I'm going to go with prospect 32 on Sam's list, number 26 on our Dodgers top 30, Nick Frasso, who, Jonathan, I want to say when he was at Loyola Marymount going into his draft year, which was the pandemic season, I think there was some first round buzz on him, wasn't there? And then he got hurt.
You're expecting me to remember the draft from 2 years ago.
I know. I'm sorry. I put you on the spot there. Yes. Sorry. Anyway, I will go ahead and claim then. I do believe there was some first round buzz in Nick Frasso. He strained his forearm during the pandemic season, wound up having Tommy John surgery last year after the Blue Jays made him a fourth round pick. They sent him to Dodgers yesterday along with Moises Brito for Mitch White and Alex DeJesus. And he came back. So he had Tommy John last June. He came back 11 months later. He's been up to 100 this summer, sitting 95, 97. His slider and his changeup are both mid-80s pitches. They need more consistency, but they've got the potential to become solid, and they'll even flash plus. So I think this is a great – I don't even know project's a fair word because he's already shown the stuff. But the Dodgers just do such a nice job developing. And to get their hands on an arm like Nick Frasso – I'm very curious to see what they do with him. So that was kind of my sneaky, good, way under the radar pickup yesterday.
All right. I'll throw out a few other names, just strictly based on where Sam Dykstra has them ranked in the 47 prospects that he ranked, and also where they were ranked on their old list and where they're ranked on their new one, which of course, you're comparing two different systems. So it's not sort of an equal trade-off there in terms of where they rank. But Estuary Ruiz went from the Padres to the Brewers. He's number 12 on Sam's list, was number 28 on the Padres list, number 9 on the Brewers list, and is part of what has suddenly become a very exciting outfield at AAA Nashville, where he joins, who's there, Frelick, Mitchell,
Weaver.
Yeah, so that's a crowded outfield there. Ben Brown. I thought one of you was going to mention Ben Brown here.
Well, we mentioned him earlier. I didn't feel like I needed to circle back to him.
Okay, all right.
We gave him and Alex Agostino the area scout love for drafting him and Logan O'Happy.
All right, and then Beck Way goes from number 21 on the Yankees list to number 12 on the Royals list, and then one guy who was unranked on the Blue Jays list and is now number 13 on the Royals list is Max Castillo. All right. Final question comes from R. Fletcher 247. How do you think the Reds did overall?
In a word, well.
Yeah, I mean, as Jonathan said, we said earlier, I think they did better for Luis Castillo than we might have imagined. And I like the three guys they got in the Tyler Molly trade. I feel like they did. They got Victor Acosta, who's a super interesting international prospect from this year's crop. They got him from Brandon Drury. I thought the Reds, even beyond the Castillo trade, did very well.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think they set it up with the huge blockbuster and who they got in Castillo. And we may see a Reds infield with Marte at third and Arroyo at shortstop, and that'll be a good return right there. And then they got a bunch of other interesting guys. They had seven guys in their top 30. I think was a pretty a very good job by the Reds front office during this deadline period.
All right. Well, thank you to R. Fletcher 247, Ant-Man 92, and Stevie D. Ailes 97 for those questions. And thanks to everybody for listening. That's going to wrap up this week's edition of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.